thanks for downloading this podcast from RNIB Connect Radio. On RNIB Connect Radio.
Hey, you're listening to the Happy Hour podcast, a trimmed down version of our hour-long show. If you're enjoying all the songs, along with the interviews, tips and chat, just catch the full show on RNIB Connect Radio. We're on every Monday at 1 p.m. with a repeat Thursday at 6 p.m. and Sunday at 10 a.m. But for now, enjoy the Happy Hour podcast. You're listening to RNIB Connect Radio. And of course, the Happy Hour is back. Holly Tuke here with Paulina. We'll be keeping you company for the next hour.
And on the show today, we'll have a few ideas to boost your happiness, from some sports chat to a conversation around finding support and living with sight loss.
We'll also hear from English television radio presenter, fashion model and menopause ambassador Lisa Snowden. She'll be breaking down stigma around menopause and discussing the impact it can have not just physically on our bodies, but mentally as well.
Yeah, she's a fantastic guest, so look forward to that later in this hour. Plus, of course, a random happy fact, this week's happy story, our music therapy moment, and of course, great music.
And coming up on the Happy Hour shortly, Barry Snell chats with Scottish blind golfer Barry McCluskey, who has been looking ahead to this year's British Blind Open. But first, here's Elton John and his 2001 track, I Want Love. Don't we all, Elton?
Delighted to be joined now by Scottish blind golfer Barry McCluskey. Barry burst onto the scene back in 2019, winning at the prestigious US Golf Championship. And he was also pivotal in helping Europe at the Vision Cup later that same year. He was hoping for a massive 2020 before coronavirus struck and affected all our lives. But he joins us now, and Barry, tough couple of years then, but we've got the British Open just around the corner.
It has been a couple of years since, you know, we've been able to, you know, do regular golf tournaments. It's been a bit difficult for everybody, you know, especially with having the visual impairment, you're getting stuck in the house and stuff. You can't get, you know, people round about you, help you out and do stuff with you. You get, like, the guides on the golf course need to be close to you. So it's been very, very tough, but we're getting out the other side of it now, and we have the British Open to look forward to in Scotland this year, which is the 4th to the 7th of July, and it's in Spray Valley in Aviemore, which is also good because it's 40 years of blind golf in Scotland, and it's the 150th Open for the professionals at St Andrews. And the Women's Open this year is at Dundonald Links as well. So three big Opens in Scotland this year, which is massive for the golf community of Scotland. You know, obviously you've got the pros, ladies and the men's, and you have the prestigious, you know, blind golf one, which allows us guys to showcase our skills just the same as the rest of them.
Now, are you still currently ranked number 2 for Scotland?
Mate, yes.
Number 3 for the UK, and number 6 for the world, still the case?
Still the case, mate, yeah, still the case at the minute.
What's your hopes for the coming season, and he's hoping to climb the ladder?
Yeah, of course, and back in February this year, I also kind of tested myself against the best blind golfers, the best disabled golfers in the world on the Edgar Tour, which was a great experience, where I finished 12th out of 46 or 47 people. So it gave me great encouragement to know that I can compete at that level as well, you know, because there's guys with other disabilities, whether it be, you know, amputees or sight hearing loss or anything like that. And these guys are playing off, you know, some of them are scratch golfers, and to know that I can go and compete and finish quite high up the rankings in one of the tournaments has given me the enthusiasm to, you know, keep going to them and try harder to you know, to maybe get a title on the Edgar Tour as well. So great to see that, you know, Edgar are progressing all the time with disabled golf. They have strong ties with the European Tour, and they're taking disabled golf onto the European Tour alongside the pros and stuff like that, you know. So it gives you something to strive towards. Also, the IBGA are striving forward now as well. You know, there's more tournaments opening up. I actually go to Spain next Sunday. I'm going out to the Spanish Open, so I'm hoping to get a decent result out there. And then obviously we've got the British and Scotland, and you know, I'm looking to perform well at that as well. And again, I've been selected for the Vision Cup, which is a great achievement, a great honour to go and represent Scotland and the rest of the world team. And this year it's going to be massive, you know, because we have some really good coverage of it. For the sheer fact that it's getting played at TPC Sawgrass with the Island Green at the 17th and stuff like that. So, you know, it's a massive course. It's a well-known course that the pros play on. And, you know, it's a big step in the right direction for visually impaired golf.
Barry, you mentioned how busy you are. You're desperate for people to get involved and try blind golf for themselves. Whether they're in Scotland, England, Northern Ireland or Wales, there's clubs throughout, isn't there, that can steer you in the right direction. How would people go about finding out more information?
Well, you have the IBGA, Barry. You've got the IBGA, which is International Blind Golf Association. They're the body who looks after all blind golf throughout the world. You know, so you've got their website. You also have England and Wales Blind Golf, where you've got the website for them. Scottish Blind Golf, you've got Northern Ireland Blind Golf. You can get blind golf in most countries, but you know, it's not publicised enough because we don't get it. We all have our websites, yeah. We all have our social media channels, you know. Just contact us through any social media channels, and I'm sure any of the countries or the country that you stay in would be more than happy to bring you along and try it out, you know, especially here in Scotland. Our numbers are fairly low because we don't know. You know, there's a lot of people that don't know about visual impairment and blind golf. So we're trying our best to promote it as best we can. And having the British Open this year has given us a massive opportunity to promote it in the right direction. And it's allowing us, you know, we have a wee bit of funds there through some grants that we've been granted that we can use to put some taster sessions on and stuff like that. So, you know, we're trying everything in our power to, you know, promote the sport in as much as we possibly can.
And how can people follow you personally?
Yeah, you can follow me on Barry McCluskey Blind Golfer on Twitter or Facebook, also on Instagram. I also have my own website, which is barrymccluskeyblindgolfer.co.uk. You can follow me on that. You know, a lot of my stuff, everything that I do gets put on there. All my sponsors and stuff like that are linked into that. I just got a massive boost at the start of this year with two new sponsors which have came on board, which is a massive help because it allows me to get to tournaments and stuff.
And just to change the subject, we've been hearing you were standing for an election recently, is that right?
Yeah, Barry, I stood as an SNP candidate in my local area, which I was lucky enough to get voted in.
Congratulations.
I'm now a councillor of North Lanarkshire Council, which is, you know, another achievement. The reason I done it is because I'm all for equality and I'm all for people who have disabilities and everything that goes with it, and, you know, and the challenges that we face, especially visual impairments. I want to be a role model through my golf and through being an elected member. I want to be a role model to the younger generation who are coming through with visual impairments to let them see that, you know, no matter your disability, if you set your goals high, you can achieve them. It's all about being inclusive and not exclusive, and the way I look at it, you know.
Barry, it's been brilliant as always talking to you. We'll hopefully speak to you again sometime in July after you've finished at the British Open. But it's been a pleasure talking to you and best of luck.
Thanks very much, Barry. It's always lovely to come on to RNIB and chat.
Good luck to Barry McCluskey at the competition next month. Now, Paulina, I have a very sweet story for you. It involves our favourite Ed Sheeran. I mean, it just had to, didn't it? So he's currently touring at the minute, as we know, because we're seeing him. And one thing that happened recently, a six-year-old boy named Daniel went to see him, and it was actually his birthday. So Ed
got the crowd to sing happy birthday to Daniel. How cute is that? Honestly,
that
it just melts my
so
heart.
So cute. Oh, bless him. That just makes me love him more. And imagine being the little wee 6-year-old. Oh, that's so cute.
Do you know what? I think I'd actually cry at my age, let alone if I was six, not gonna lie.
Oh, totally. maybe we should stand up with a little sign and say, it's our birthday.
Yeah, can we have happy birthday sung to us, please, Ed? Yeah, let's do that. Okay, right, let's make a sign. But seriously, could you imagine just having that? I mean, honestly, he's got a heart of gold.
Can you tell we're fans? Unfortunately, we don't have any insurance on the system today. But you know what? I can do some audio magic and I could play a little clip so we can all hear the happy birthday song if you'd like, Holly.
Let's do it. And that is why she's the producer, not me. But no, seriously, let's do it.
Here it is.
50,000 people sing Daniel happy birthday. Happy birthday to you.
Oh, it's just adorable, isn't it?
Oh, bless. That is so sweet. That's like a memory you're going to cherish forever. There we go. Happy birthday to little Daniel from us here at RNIB Connect Radio as well. A little bit of a belated birthday, but it doesn't matter.
No, have some extra birthday cake on us. Now, still to come on the happy hour, we have our happy fact for this week. We hear a personal story about living with sight loss, and next up, menopause ambassador and TV personality Lisa Snowden breaks down stigma around menopause.
Menopause. It's a natural part of aging, yet despite it happening to half of our population, new research reveals that 92% of women in the UK feel unprepared for the menopause, and nearly half of them feel alone during that time of their life. But why is that, and how can a new campaign by Tena change it? Joining us to chat overcoming stigma and starting a dialogue around menopause is presenter, model, and menopause advocate Lisa Snowden. Lisa, it is lovely having you here with me today.
Thank you so much for talking to me. It's great. It's great to be here.
So let's chat about those statistics, because they're quite shocking. We're looking at what 92% of women don't feel ready for their menopause. That is insane to think about.
It is insane. It's totally insane. And, you know, that's a huge amount of people who are unprepared. They have no idea when it's coming. They have no idea what to expect. And it's that statistic is way too high. But you know what? There's such a stigma and there's such a shame sort of surrounding menopause, surrounding aging in society, you know, talking about pelvic floor issues. We just don't talk about it, you know. So the conversation hasn't been happening. We've swept it all under the carpet, and we've sort of traditionally dealt with it by ourselves. You know, women that have come before us have had to just suffer in silence. And it's a really lonely time. It's horrible. When you don't know what's happening, you feel completely out of your depth, very alone and very, very low.
Because that was your own experience. You experienced a menopause quite early in your life.
Yeah, I mean, that's another thing that I didn't expect it to come at when I was about 42. So that is, I mean, it's 30, late 30s, early 40s, it can happen. You know, for me, I always thought it was something that happened when I was much older, when I had fully white hair, you know, like really, really much, much older. And so it was a little bit of a shock. And initially, I didn't know what was happening. And the doctor also didn't know what was happening. There wasn't enough education. There was even less than there is now. So that was 8 years ago. So I was 42. And I was initially prescribed antidepressants because I did go to the doctor's surgery with the symptoms of anxiety, depression. I would just burst into tears. I cried in the surgery. And, you know, that is some of the early signs, you know, and there's so much misinformation around menopause, A, that it happens We didn't know that it happens earlier. And B, people just think it's when your periods stop or if you have hot flashes. It's not ever been kind of directly linked with, you know, all the other things. So the sort of aching muscles and your joints hurting and, you know, repeated urinary tract infections, brain fog, the depression, the anxiety, it's not ever been sort of linked up properly. So a lot of us have been in the dark. And so that's why with Tenor and the research has been so powerful. And they've got this amazing online guide, which is an educational guide with infrequently asked questions that you can go on and you can have a look at everything, all different aspects of menopause. Every kind of question is up there on the site as a guide so that us women can be more prepared. There's also a really powerful video. I don't know if you've gotten to see it yet. It's called The Second Coming of Age. And it's a really beautiful, powerful video with a little bit of humor in there, kind of highlighting some of the more traditional or well-known kind of symptoms, which are the hot flushes and sort of like, oh, what have I done? I've left my phone in the dishwasher. You know, those kind of like moments. But there's some really touching moments, you know, sort of encouraging us to speak intergenerationally. I can never say it properly, intergenerationally. So we're speaking within amongst our families. We're talking to the younger people in our lives. We're talking to our sisters, everybody. We're having this conversation and we're being honest and open and transparent about it because we need to. There's nothing to be ashamed about. And once you've got a handle and you know what's happening, you can make an educated decision on the kind of route you want to go down and just taking better care of yourself. And, you know, it's going to be a happier home life for everybody the more we talk about it. Because, yes, it affects us women, but it also affects men because relationships break down, families are torn apart, people want to leave work, bosses don't understand what's happening. You know, it's about talking about it and people can be there to support you. And that's why I want to just sing it from the rooftops and keep shouting about it.
No, it completely makes sense because thinking back to my own experience, it would probably have been so much helpful to my own mom when I was a teenager and she was going through menopause, but I didn't know what was going through. She was very, I think she was experiencing a lot of the symptoms you mentioned, anxiety, maybe a bit of like anger even, and just being really having a, just not handling her emotions and probably not really understanding what's happening to her. Because as you said, I feel like one of the most popular symptoms that is mentioned when you do talk about menopause is the hot flushes, but you don't really discuss how it can affect your mental health and how you can really feel about it and how it has a knock on effect on everything else in your life.
Yeah, it's right. Like younger girls and younger boys, everybody needs to know about it because they can be so much more understanding. You know, if mom is acting out of character or your auntie or your friend, you know, you can go, actually, you know, because all of a sudden out of the blue, that person that you used to recognize is experiencing these really horrible, very emotional. And like you said, anger. I had so much anger out of nowhere. I go from 0 to 60 and it was like, rah, it was like red. I just saw red. And my poor fiance was just like, what is happening? So when I finally got diagnosed and I knew that I was perimenopausal, I went straight to my partner and I said, this is what is happening. But from the research that Tenor have done, 51% of women are too afraid to talk to their partner about it. They're too ashamed. They just don't know how to approach the subject and they want to try and deal with it on their own. And this is not the answer. You know, women can't suffer in silence anymore. We need to have this conversation. It needs to be not taboo. You know, we need to drop those old fashioned attitudes surrounding the menopause and talk about it because, you know, yes, a lot of women are afraid of it because it seems very scary. But once you know what's happening, it's not as bad. Once you know that these are associated with the perimenopause and menopause, and you feel like you're not going crazy, because I'm sure your mum at one point probably thought she was going crazy, as I did. You're like, why am I not handling stress? Why can't I even take the kids to school? Why can't I even like go to the supermarket? Or I forgot my purse. It's like little things that happen that are out of the blue and very, you know, uncharacteristic kind of traits. They just hit you like a freight train. So, you know, we do need to have this conversation and we need to be unashamed about it and kind of just know that once you've got a handle on it, there's some positives You know, there's some major positives, no periods and no pain and things like that. You know, it's a time in a woman's life to be celebrated. It's like you got to this age, you're much wiser, and it's like a new lease of life, a new phase of life, rather seeing it than the end of your life.
It's almost like you are 100% you, with absolutely nothing holding you back.
I love that. It's exactly how it is, Paulina. Beautifully said. It's like, you know, a lot of women have had their children. The children have grown up. They can go off and they can do things that they want to do. They've got the confidence. They've got the wisdom. And so you can finally say, this is my time. So there's so many positives. Absolutely.
Now, I'm curious. Obviously, it took a while to get your diagnosis. But once you got it, was it easy to have a conversation with other women? Did you maybe friends or family members to kind of help them understand what's going on? How did you find that? And how did you start this conversation? Because it can be a bit awkward.
I have never felt awkward about it. I honestly have always been the kind of person that when something's happening to me, I talk about it. And I don't know why I'm like that. I just am. And so I just think sharing is caring. I'm like, throw it all into the mix. I've got no qualms about saying, God, you know, I'm having these hot flushes, or, you know, my period's so heavy. What's happening? Like, I'll just talk about it because it's life. You know, I'm not that kind of person that's quite shy. So I did a lot of talking on my Instagram. I did a lot of talking about the flushes and the different stages of the symptoms, because it's a moving target. They change. Sometimes they just go all together and you think, ah, and then they come back. So it's constantly moving and changing. But I have always been very open with my family. I've got two younger sisters. So they're very prepared and ready for it because I've been so open. I was with my niece and my nephew on holiday last week, and I was talking about the menopause, and my 10-year-old nephew was like, Auntie Lily, what's the menopause? And so I sat and I spoke to him about it. You know, because you learn about periods and puberty and pregnancy and all of that stuff in a woman's life, in the life cycle. You never learn about perimenopause or the menopause. And it's just, it happens to us all. And we need to be educated about it, and we need to be prepared. And we need to get rid of this stigma. So that's why I'm massively behind this campaign, The Last Lonely Menopause, because I just don't want women to suffer in silence anymore. It shouldn't be happening. It should be spoken about, and it should be embraced, and women should be respected and helped and supported at this time.
So this actually brings me to a question. Obviously, we're talking about the campaign, and there is a lovely website we can visit and find lots of tips about menopause and the effect it has on our mental health and anything else connecting to it. So where can we go?
So you should go to tenor.co.uk/infrequently asked questions. And so there's lots and lots of information on there. It's an educational guide. There's also beautiful anecdotes and sort of nuggets of wisdom from women who have also been through the menopause, who are going into the menopause. And there's a beautiful film as well on there for everybody to watch, which is very touching and very powerful. And I think a lot of people will get a lot from.
Okay, so I guess I just have one last question for you, Lisa. What would be your number one tip for, I guess, managing and going through menopause when it still first happens?
Oh my gosh, there's so many tips. So the first thing I would say is keep an eye on your symptoms. Get a list, write it down. Start keeping a note of hot flushes, brain fog, night sweats, anxiety, you know, anything that starts to come up health-wise, write it down so that you can go to your doctor with your list. So like when I was 42, I just burst into tears. And so he was like, oh dear, emotional woman sitting there. And then I was like, I'm depressed, I'm anxious. So of course I didn't say my periods have gone really haywire. I didn't say about all the other things that I was experiencing. It was just the mental health aspects. So if you write down everything, you're armed, you're prepared, and you can then tell your doctor that this is happening. And then they'll start to, obviously they'll do tests to rule out other things that could be underlying issues. But fundamentally, you will get your point across because you've got a very small window to go into the surgery with. And hopefully they can rule out things, do bloods, and get to the bottom of it and get you on your HRT.
Fantastic. Lisa Snowden, thank you so much for helping break down the stigma around menopause and for speaking on RNIB Connect Radio.
Thank you so much, Paulina. It's lovely to speak to you.
If you're not the one, then why does my soul feel glad today? If you're not the one, then why does my hand fit yours this way?
If You're Not the One by Daniel Bedingfield on RNIB Connect Radio. The happy hour continues, and now it's time for our random happy fact. Paulina, you've got one for me, right?
Yeah, I have it right in front of me. So you know how I love looking at what random national day it is this month.
I do.
So I got a special one. It's not really, I don't think it's celebrated in here in the UK, but I think it's quite, it's gotten quite popular in the USA. So are you ready?
I am ready. Hit me with it.
So apparently in June 20th, we celebrate a National Hike with a Geek Day.
Okay, I like the sound of this.
it's not complicated. It's exactly what they say. June 20th, they want to encourage anyone who works in a sort of sedentary type of job like IT or accounting or something like that to, you know, get out and enjoy the fresh air.
I mean, that's really important. I feel like that should be done most days rather than just one particular day of the year. I do really like that. And, you know, we're all about promoting well-being and physical exercise on the happy hour, so that is great. I do wonder, though, how do people feel about the geek side of it?
I'm not sure. Like, how do you tell if someone, like, someone could be an accountant and they could not, they don't have to be a geek?
Exactly. Do you think they're just thinking, oh, because they use computers more than, say, I don't know, builders or something like that, they're a geek? Or do you feel like they might disagree with that?
Wait, if computer use is what establishes whether you're a geek, wouldn't that make us geeks because we're working on our computers all the time?
Yeah, we probably would actually. So maybe we are just hidden geeks. Who knows?
Okay, so apparently we'll be both celebrating that this month we'll be heading out for National Hike with a Geek Day. If you're thinking of joining us, drop us a line, as always, radio@rnib.org.uk. We love to hear what you guys are up to.
Give us some inspiration to get out away from our computers.
Absolutely.
Okay, now it's time to find out what life is really like living with sight loss. Our Ellie Marsh has more.
You're listening to RNIB Connect Radio. Now, as well as covering the latest news in the blind and partially sighted world here on Connect Radio, we also like to hear about your lived experiences. Andy Corson joins us now to share a little bit about his sight loss journey with us. Thank you very much for joining us, Andy. So the beginning seems like a good place to start. How did sight loss show up in your life, and how did it impact your life when you were first diagnosed with sight loss?
I was born blind, but my parents didn't know until I was about 6 months. They did some tests and they confirmed that I was visually impaired, and my mum accessed support through RNIB and other local services in Bristol and then Gloucestershire.
And being born blind, what were some of the biggest challenges then growing up and having sight loss throughout your whole childhood and into your adolescence?
Well, challenges didn't really start till I was at school. And even though I was in a mainstream school, I hadn't known any different. I mean, I'd been to a nursery for children with disabilities, but the transition to a mainstream school when I was four was very smooth, because I was in class with the mainstream pupils throughout the time that I was there. But I would go for lessons to learn Braille, and that included practicing reading and writing. So I was never excluded from something, because while the other kids were learning their literacy and numeracy, I was doing all that in Braille. But where it did become noticeable was playtime. All the other kids would kind of hang out together, and I would just find a spot near the edge of the playground and just stand by myself and daydream. That was the f- first big difference. But at home, I was included in everything that my sister and her friends did, or my mum's friend's daughters did, because we would go out together a lot and play. We'd go swimming, go to the local park or a day out somewhere, and we'd all just mix in together, and I wasn't any different. But the biggest difference was isolation and being overlooked at playtime at school.
That does sound really tough when you're so young as well.
Yeah, but I was only in mainstream school till I was 8, and then I went to a school for the blind by accident, really, because we where we lived originally in Gloucestershire, the mainstream school I went to was very inclusive. But then when we moved to Birmingham, we moved just after Christmas, and it was easier to send me to a special school in Erdington than find a mainstream primary that would where I could just carry on where I'd left off in Gloucester.
So what were which did you prefer then? And how did the two experiences compare, being in a school for children with sight loss compared to being in a mainstream school? What was your experience of that?
Well, I preferred the mainstream to the first school I went to, Priestley Smith, because I liked the teachers in the mainstream better, and I felt we were I found it difficult to make friends with the children from the school for the blind. It did get better. After 6 months or so, I got a new teacher, and he was a really good teacher. And I was then happier. But I didn't. So he was my teacher for a year, and then I went to Worcester College. But the best school for the blind that I went to was Royal Blind School in Edinburgh, because it had a real community feel to it. Everybody knew everyone else, and there were only about 30 pupils in the senior school, so it was easy to get to know each other. I made a lot of friends there, which I hadn't done so much at Priestley Smith or Worcester.
Do you think that some of the challenges that you faced growing up and going through the different school systems, do you think that they've given you any new opportunities or possibilities while you were doing that that might not have been there otherwise?
I think what they showed was that as I got older, I preferred mixing with people older than myself, because I didn't feel peer pressure from them. Whereas even now, I'm 40 now, and I still feel a slight peer pressure from people my own age.
So finally, Andy, we are running out of time, unfortunately, but I'm wondering if you've got any advice from your lived experience for our listeners. If you could give them one piece of advice, what would it be?
Be assertive. Be assertive, but don't be demanding. But be clear to others about what you need, and also listen and learn from others, especially those who you can see are going to make a positive difference to your life.
Yeah, that is really great advice. Thank you, Andrew, for joining us on RNIB Connect Radio.
Thanks so much, Ellie Marsh, there with that interview. And Andy will be back in a moment on the Happy Hour to share his choice for our music therapy moment. But for now, here's this new track from Emily Sandé, and it's a great one.
I bought myself an aeroplane to see how high that it could take me. I made it past the Milky Way, but it seems...
There Isn't Much by Emily Sandé from her new album Let's Say For Instance, which dropped last month. Now, unfortunately, we've reached the end of today's show. If you missed any of the interviews or would like to catch up on a previous episode, give us a follow on our podcast. Just search for RNIB Happy Hour Podcast online.
Now, returning for our final track and sharing his music therapy choice with us in a moment will be Andy Causton.
Remember, you can also share a song that means a lot to you with us. Just drop us a line on radio@rnib.org.uk. Now it's bye from us, and here's Andy with his beloved song choice.
When I was very little, I used to love Karma Chameleon by Culture Club. Every time we'd go and visit my mum's best friend, Rose, my sister would go off and play with two of her daughters, and I would go and listen to records with Rose's stepdaughter. One of her records was Karma Chameleon, and I'd always ask her to put that one on. And in later years, I discovered that Boy George was gay, and I began to idolise him as a gay man. And knowing about the way he dressed and looked helped me define myself and eventually come out. So I'd say that song has been very important, and it founded my love of 80s and early 90s music as well.
You are listening to the Happy Hour podcast, a trimmed down version of our hour-long show. If you've enjoyed the songs and would like to hear them in full, along with all the interviews, tips and chat, just catch the full show on RNIB Connect Radio. We're on every Monday at 1 p.m. with a repeat Thursday at 6 p.m. and Sunday at 10 a.m. But for now, thank you for listening to the Happy Hour podcast.
For more downloads like these, visit rnibconnectradio.org.uk/podcasts.